Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hoprock. First on this week's program, these extremists are headed to the Arizona legislature next year. The story was written by Jared McDonald Evoy of the Arizona Mirror and was posted on the New Times website on November 29th. Arizona has been a hotbed for conspiratorial and extremist ideology, and a number of incoming lawmakers, some returning to the Capitol and others who will be new legislators, will likely continue that trend. A number of lawmakers who will be at the state capitol in the coming months have amplified everything from QAnon to white nationalists to anti-LGBTQ rhetoric. Some have even touted their support for and participation in anti-government extremist groups. These lawmakers, some of whom are in leadership positions for the GOP majority, will be key in driving the agenda in the legislature for the next 2 years. Senator David Farnsworth. Incumbent Republican Senator David Farnsworth, a dyed-in-the-wool QAnon believer, handily won re-election. Farnsworth has been known for being a champion of conspiracy theories and became something of a hero to the political fringe. In 2019, Farnsworth gave an exclusive interview to the Falun Gong-backed newspaper, The Epoch Times, about his belief that the state's child safety agency was behind sex trafficking, making the claim without any evidence. The reporter who conducted the interview has a record of anti-Semitism and racism and has promoted QAnon. In 2020, Farnsworth told the Mirror that QAnon was a credible group. He said he had no idea that QAnon had been deemed a domestic terror threat by the FBI more than a year earlier, and he didn't care. Quite frankly, I don't have time to look into things like that, he said. Farnsworth will be the chairman of the Senate Education Committee. He isn't the only QAnon-believing senator to win re-election this year. Senator Janae Shamp. Janae Shamp, who was present during some of the most violent moments of the January 6, 2021 attempted coup, promoted QAnon multiple times on social media. Shamp, an ardent supporter of President Trump, has previously denied knowledge of QAnon when asked about her beliefs. Shamp was the co-chair of a controversial special legislative committee that shared the same acronym as a popular QAnon acronym. The Novel Coronavirus Southwestern Intergovernmental Committee, or NCSWIC, shared the acronym with the QAnon slogan, "Nothing can stop what is coming," a phrase parroted by QAnon adherents, suggesting that mass arrests or even executions of members of the deep state would be coming. Shamp called any link between QAnon and the committee as a goofy accusation, despite speakers having connections to QAnon and her own Facebook history of posting QAnon content, including the phrase. Shamp will be the co-chair of the Senate Committee on the Military and the Border. She will also be the Senate Majority Leader, the number two Republican in the chamber. Senator Wendy Rogers. Flagstaff Republican Senator Wendy Rogers, who has not only boosted QAnon conspiracy theories but has eagerly been interviewed by multiple anti-Semites, also won her re-election bid. The senator has a strong presence on social media, where she amassed more than 380,000 followers on X and more than 65,000 subscribers on Telegram. She often posts links from far-right websites and personalities, and her posts are often shared by far-right influencers and personalities. Since she was elected in 2020, Rogers has become a darling of the Arizona GOP, leveraging support of election conspiracy theories into a national following that she's used to become a fundraising juggernaut. Over the years, she has become more ingrained with the far right and gone from amplifying their messages to participating in their events. In 2021, Rogers appeared multiple times on an online broadcast network that had made multiple anti-Semitic remarks. The network, True News, has a history of spreading anti-Semitic rhetoric, including a piece in which Rick Wiles, its founder, spent 90 minutes ranting about seditious Jews that were orchestrating Trump's impeachment. Wiles also has called the Jewish people tyrants and claimed that the Antichrist will be a homosexual Jew. Both times she appeared on True News, Rogers was interviewed by Lauren Witzke, a conspiracy theorist with a history of anti-Semitism. Witzke is connected to other known white nationalists and anti-Semites, participated in a white nationalist youth event in Arizona in 2022, and echoed white nationalist beliefs during an appearance on the white nationalist podcast, No White Guilt, on which she promoted the Great Replacement Theory. Rogers has touted support from the anti-government extremist Oath Keepers and delivered a video message at the America First Political Action Conference, a conference hosted by known white nationalist and anti-Semitic Nick Fuentes. Rogers will be the chairwoman for the Senate Committee on Judiciary and Elections. Senator-elect Corrine Werner. Senator-elect Corrine Werner, a Republican who was previously on the Scottsdale Unified Governing School Board, has appeared at the Capitol alongside Rogers and others promoting education curriculum created by the far-right PragerU. The material includes videos where historical figures like Christopher Columbus claim slavery was better than being killed, and Frederick Douglass claims that the founding fathers who owned slaves had ending slavery on their to-do list. Werner will co-chair the Senate Education Committee and will be the chairwoman of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. Senator-elect Mark Finchem. Mark Finchem, who previously served in the Arizona House of Representatives before an unsuccessful run for Arizona Secretary of State, will also be joining the Arizona Senate in January. He has long been no stranger to conspiracy theories, and lately has latched on to a QAnon conspiracy theory in Tennessee, where he has admitted to accessing confidential financial information that is tightly controlled by federal law. Finchem has often courted those from the fringe, and especially those in the QAnon world. He has spoken at their conventions and held fundraisers with known QAnon believers and 9/11 truthers. He has also raised money from the Oath Keepers and was present at the Capitol during the events of January 6, 2021. The Prescott senator-elect also was instrumental in pushing false narratives around the 2020 election that ultimately led to protesters storming the Capitol on January 6th. Finchem will be the chair of the Senate Federalism Committee. Representative Steve Montenegro. The Arizona House of Representatives will see some new and returning conspiratorial-minded lawmakers, some in high positions of leadership. They include Steve Montenegro, who was elected by his caucus this week to be the new Speaker of the House. While many may know the lawmaker from the scandal several years ago, after reports that he traded sexually explicit texts with a staffer, Montenegro also has been a key behind-the-scenes player in the election denial world. Montenegro works for the America Project as its national policy director. The nonprofit group was started by former Overstock.com CEO Patrick Byrne and contributed more than half of the funding for the Senate's partisan audit of the 2020 election, putting in more than $3.2 million. Byrne has been a leading voice in 2020 election fraud claims and has railed against the so-called deep state. He was also an attendee of an hour-long meeting at the White House during the final days of Trump's presidency, in which he, Sidney Powell, and disgraced retired General Michael Flynn urged the president to overturn the election. It was later discovered as well that Montenegro was one of the people who had control over the controversial Audit War Room Twitter account to give an in-state perspective to the tweets. Montenegro has also appeared alongside Byrne, Flynn, and other election conspiracy theorists through his work for the America Project. And he has helped bring those conspiracy theorists to the state capitol, being part of the misinformation-filled committee about COVID-19 that was supported and promoted by Byrne's group, as well as President-elect Donald Trump's border czar, Tom Homan. Montenegro isn't the only connection to the Arizona Senate's audit of the 2020 election. Representative Alexander Kolodin. Former Cyber Ninjas attorney Alexander Kolodin was reelected to the House. The attorney has worked for a number of election deniers and Republican elected officials, including on challenges to the election. Kolodin represented QAnon conspiracy theorist Melody Jennings, who was fighting against a temporary restraining order being sought against her group for monitoring drop boxes and harassing voters who used them. Further reporting by the Arizona Mirror found that group to have connections to the Oath Keepers and other militias. Kolodin was also hired by the Arizona Republican Party in a failed legal challenge to early voting in Arizona that made many claims, including the ballot drop boxes in Arizona were unconstitutional. Representative Rachel Jones. Southern Arizona conservative Rachel Jones also won her re-election bid. Jones is married to prominent election denier Seth Keschel, who has spread a number of falsehoods around the election for a number of years. Jones has been a proponent of a slew of debunked election conspiracies, and even this year theorized that her GOP seatmate, Cory Maguire, lost his election because of fraud, despite having no evidence for making such a claim. Election denial isn't the only conspiratorial thinking that will be making its way to the Arizona House next session either. Representative-elect Lisa Fink, a Glendale Republican, has worked closely with the Gilbert-based hate group Family Watch International to try to stop comprehensive sex education in schools. Family Watch International has promoted conversion therapy and claims that transgender people are mentally ill. Fink worked as a representative for an offshoot organization of Family Watch International called the Protect Arizona Children Coalition, which is against teaching sex education in the state. Fink will be joined by other culture warriors such as Pamela Carter, sister of original Wonder Woman Linda Carter, who has opposed same-sex marriage and pushed for firearms in schools. Next, a story written by T.J. LeHeru and posted on November 27th. Board yanks license of ex-sheriff's deputy who cuffed 82-year-old lady. In August, Arizona's top police licensing board opened an investigation into Michael Uyahara, a former Maricopa County Sheriff's deputy who'd forcefully handcuffed an 82-year-old woman during a 2022 interaction. This month, the board completed its investigation and voted to revoke Uyahara's law enforcement license. Uyahara was one of seven current or former law enforcement officers from across Arizona to earn punishment from the Arizona Peace Officer Standards and Training Board at its November 20th meeting. Known as ASPOST, the board licenses all law enforcement officers in the state and is one of the few agencies in Arizona with the power to discipline police. The 12-member board includes Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays, two rural sheriffs, Phoenix City Council member Kevin Robinson, and Ryan Thornell, director of the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry. The board's principal task is certifying all officers across the state, but it also has the power to revoke or suspend the certifications of officers who demonstrate troubling behavior. As of its November meeting, ASPOST has opened 48 investigations into officers and punished 43 this year. So far in 2024, the board has punished officers for putting the muzzle of a gun to a woman's head, asking two high school girls when they lost their virginity, driving while under the influence, and lying to supervisors and investigators. This month, the board penalized officers who drove drunk, lied, violated a no-contact order against a significant other, and refused to leave a casino. Here are the most notable cases on which the board decided this month. License revoked. Uyahara received the harshest punishment, revocation of his peace officer certification. Uyahara was part of a team responding to an October 2022 call from a Sun City woman who said her husband had shot himself. A paramedic told Uyahara that a neighbor who used a cane was coming over. When the neighbor arrived, Uyahara confronted her at the door and prevented her from entering. According to video of the interaction shown at the meeting, Uyahara denied the woman entry and then threatened to arrest her after she told him to listen for 1 second. He handcuffed her, only taking her out of cuffs when other officers came outside to see what was going on. The woman later complained to the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, claiming Uyahara bruised her wrists and arm. The office conducted an internal investigation, which found that Uyahara made at least 7 inaccurate statements in his report of the incident. One was that the woman tried to push past him to enter the house, which was directly contradicted by video evidence. Another was that he thought she might have taken the gun from the home and was returning to the scene, despite officers having informed Uyahara that the gun was already secured. Uyahara told internal investigators that his inaccurate statements were the result of filling out his report, standing up in the sun, while holding his computer with one hand. But police also saw video of him, during the incident, sitting at a table in the house's courtyard, filling out a report. Compliance specialist Tim Shea told the board that when internal investigators asked Uyahara if he could have done anything differently, the officer said, "Yeah, I could have shot her. I could have tased her. I could have kick-swept her foot and knocked her to the ground." The board voted unanimously to take away Uyahara's peace officer certification. Uyahara had not been working for the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office since April 1st, when he resigned before the internal investigation was completed. Lying to supervisors. The board also handed an 18-month suspension to former Payson police officer Jeffrey Gomez, who was accused of lying to his bosses. The board opened an investigation into Gomez in May. At issue was his request to take February off, supposedly to help his father with a construction project. In reality, Gomez was planning to attend a law enforcement class in California with the hope of becoming a police officer there. According to the board's investigation, helping his father was a backup option in case he wasn't approved for the class. According to Assistant Attorney General Joe Dilo, Gomez did not tell his bosses about the class because he was worried about potential negative repercussions if the administration knew that he planned on attending the lateral academy. Gomez resigned on March 29th before he could be fired for dishonesty. His suspension runs until September 29th, 2025. No contact order. Former Safford police officer Kevin Lamoureux received a retroactive 2-year suspension due to a 2022 incident. In January of that year, Lamoureux's wife reported to the Pima Police Department that her husband had physically assaulted her several months earlier. The department helped her get an emergency order of protection that contained a no-contact order. But Lamoureux violated it by reaching out to her. Lamoureux then resigned from the agency, though Assistant Attorney General Mark Brochtel did not say when. Because it was retroactive, Lamoureux's 2-year suspension has already ended. Don't touch me, bro. Former Tucson Airport Authority officer Adam Barzar was having a good time at Desert Diamond Casino in Sahuarita one day in April 2022. Perhaps too good of a time. Security asked Barzar, who was intoxicated, to leave the casino, but he refused. He was arrested for trespassing and disorderly conduct. While being detained by officers, he said, "Don't touch me, bro," to one of them, and swatted an officer's hand away, according to Brechtel. Barzar was demoted from sergeant to police officer and later resigned from the department in June 2023 for a behavioral issue unrelated to the casino arrest. The board suspended Barzar's certification for 2 years until June 2025. Goodyear Police sued for killing disabled Army vet attempting suicide. This next story was written by T.J. LeHeroux and was posted on November 26th. 2 years ago, Daniel Romero was at work when he checked his in-home security camera and saw his brother Adam stabbing himself with a kitchen knife. A call to 911 summoned the Goodyear Police Department. But instead of helping Romero, a Goodyear officer shot him 3 times, killing him. That's according to a civil rights lawsuit filed November 12th, exactly 2 years after Adam Romero's death, by the Romero's mother, Linda Figueroa. The lawsuit claims that former Goodyear Police Chief Santiago Rodriguez and officers Matthew Pitcher and Justin Antholt violated Romero's civil rights. Goodyear police officers were called to help Adam, the suit says. Instead, they killed him. Kristen Wong, the attorney representing Figueroa, declined to comment to Phoenix New Times. Goodyear spokesperson Jordan Bird said, "We have not received a claim, nor are we familiar with this matter." The online docket for the case suggests that the city and the officers have not yet been served with the lawsuit. The lawsuit concerns the events of November 12, 2022. At 5:33 p.m. that evening, the suit says, Daniel Romero called 911 to report that his brother was trying to kill himself. Per the suit, Daniel Romero advised the dispatcher that Adam was a disabled veteran who suffers from PTSD and that he would not be aggressive to officers and that he's a veteran who just needs help. The lawsuit does not specify the nature of Adam Romero's disability. A GoFundMe set up after his death says that Romero served in the Army. After calling 911, Daniel Romero left work and arrived home 15 minutes later. But 10 minutes before that and 5 minutes after the call, Pitcher and Antholt forced their way into the home. The lawsuit alleges the city and the police then committed a litany of errors, including refusing to let Daniel help and calm Adam, storming into the house with guns drawn, and not involving a crisis response team. It also blames the officers and the city for not using less lethal force. Never said a word. According to the lawsuit, Pitcher decided to force entry into the home after another officer saw blood in the kitchen. The officers, some of whom the suit says carried ballistic shields, found Romero on the back porch, seated on a couch and holding a fillet knife in his left hand. According to the suit, the officers, who were about 10 to 20 feet away from Romero, commanded him to drop the knife. He did not. Then, the suit says, Adam got up and came out from behind the couch, at which point Pitcher fired 3 times. At the same time, Antholt fired his taser. Then, officers ordered again that Romero should drop his knife, which fell to the side near his limp body. Then, per the suit, Pitcher asked Romero to crawl toward him, but Romero didn't move, as he already had a stabbing wound to his neck, was shot 3 times, and tased once. Antholt fired the taser at Romero again, striking him. At that point, they then detained him and began rendering aid. Adam never walked toward or ran toward the officers, the suit says. Adam did not fight, punch, kick, or strike any officers. In fact, Adam never even touched them. Adam never said anything to officers. He never said a word. The lawsuit says another officer on the scene, identified as Lieutenant Jamie Benker, whom the suit claims did not think Adam was going to get up and stab them, said that he could see the moment in Adam's eyes when he died. Figueroa's lawsuit, which claims violations of Romero's Fourth and Fourteenth Amendment rights, seeks general, special, and punitive damages, as well as attorney's fees and costs. Goodyear has not answered her complaint in court, and no hearings have been scheduled. Next, a story written by T.J. LeHeru and posted on November 26th. Report, Carrie Lake in discussions to join far-right TV station Newsmax. After losing her second consecutive statewide race, former local newscaster and Republican candidate Carrie Lake is looking for a job. And after it turned out that she was pretty bad at politics, she might be slated to return to television. According to political news website Mediaite, two unnamed sources said Lake's already in negotiations to join far-right media network Newsmax, which has become right-wing viewers' favorite propaganda hub and taken MAGA fanaticism to a new level during Joe Biden's presidency. Notably, given Lake's history of election rhetoric, Newsmax leadership steered it away from spreading election conspiracy theories after being sued by voting machine maker Smartmatic. Lake and Newsmax both denied such negotiations were taking place, with Lake responding to Mediaite by simply saying, "Get better sources." Friday, Lake went on TV to talk about her next career moves, making an appearance on, you guessed it, Newsmax. Fawning anchor Rob Finnerty brown-nosed Lake, telling her that people like you, a lot of people like you, and I know that they want to see you succeed, and suggesting she could run for president in 2028 by referencing Richard Nixon's political losses before taking the White House. Rob, you're giving me anxiety right now, Lake replied, adding she wanted to spend the holidays with her family before deciding what's next. I'm going to take a look at all kinds of options that are coming my way, and I'm going to make a decision, Lake said. But I'm not in a huge hurry right now, as I'm actually enjoying just a little bit of time to relax and enjoy my family. Mexico instead? The Mediaite report comes as speculation about Lake's future swirls. Republican consultant Marcus Dell'Artino told Phoenix New Times less than a week after the election that he heard Lake was interested in running for the chair of the Arizona Republican Party. Dell'Artino and consultant Barrett Marson both mentioned that Lake might be a good fit for a media organization such as Turning Point USA, founded in Arizona by Charlie Kirk. The Arizona Republic's Elvia Diaz also wrote about recent speculation from the Mexican newspaper Reforma that President-elect Donald Trump may choose Lake as his next ambassador to Mexico. Diaz opined that such a decision could have disastrous implications for both countries. Lake left Fox 10 in March of 2021 to become a full-time MAGA fanatic and a candidate for governor in Arizona. She gained national attention for her impassioned fealty to Trump, whose bombastic style she adopted. But she couldn't quite chart her own path to electoral success, losing the election to Katie Hobbs by about 17,000 votes. However, Lake refused to concede, and still has not admitted that she lost. Her constant and baseless allegations of mass voter fraud were rejected by the state's courts. Lake also had to settle a defamation lawsuit filed against her by Maricopa County Recorder Stephen Ricker. She again lost a bid for statewide office this year, but this time it was a blowout. Running for the U.S. Senate, Lake lost to Democratic Representative Ruben Gallego by about 80,000 votes, even as Trump won the state by 188,000 votes. The loss was indicative of Lake's deep unpopularity among independents and even some Republicans. Zach Buchanan wrote this next story that was posted on November 26th. Former Coyotes player Paul Bissonnette attacked at Scottsdale Eatery. On Sunday, former Arizona Coyotes player and current pro hockey commentator Paul Bissonnette was assaulted by six men after he tried to break up an argument at the Scottsdale restaurant Houston's. The attack sent Bissonnette to the hospital and landed all six men in jail. According to Scottsdale police, the attack happened at about 7:30 p.m. In an interview with the hockey podcast Spittin' Chicklets, Bissonnette said he intervened when a man began aggressively yelling at an assistant manager. I walk over, I grab this guy's arm, and I say, "Listen, buddy, if you keep harassing and assaulting the staff here, we're going to have to go outside, and we're going to have some problems," Bissonnette recounted on the podcast. "The minute that left my mouth, the guy beside him starts throwing punches." According to Bissonnette, that set off a 6-versus-1 brawl that, over about 3.5 minutes, made its way from inside the restaurant out to the parking lot. In the process, Bissonnette lost his shirt and both of his shoes. Some of the men also attacked a restaurant employee. "I'm taking some, and I'm giving some," Bissonnette said on the podcast. Bissonnette was taken to the hospital, but said on the podcast that he was able to return home later that evening. Phoenix New Times has requested the arrest report from the incident, but has yet to receive it. According to police, the following people were arrested on the following charges: Henry P. Mesker, misdemeanor assault and disorderly conduct; John G. Carroll, misdemeanor disorderly conduct; William J. Carroll, misdemeanor disorderly conduct, 2 counts, and misdemeanor assault, 2 counts. Danny Bradley, misdemeanor disorderly conduct and misdemeanor assault. Edward J. Jennings, misdemeanor disorderly conduct and misdemeanor assault. And Sean M. Daly, felony aggravated assault, forgery, misdemeanor disorderly conduct. Bissonnette told the podcast that he would set them all free if he could get a rematch. "I'm so fired up right now. I would be willing to waive every single charge if I could go behind a fucking barn somewhere and go one-on-one," he said. "Every fucking guy, one after the other." The program continues now with the cover story from this week's print edition of the New Times. Written by the Phoenix New Times staff and posted on November 26th, "Who biffed it the hardest this year?" Here are Arizona's top turkeys. Giving thanks? No thanks. At Phoenix New Times, we'd prefer to observe the Thanksgiving holiday in a different fashion. While Valley residents sit down with their families and desperately avoid talking politics, we're steering into the skid. While you roast a turkey at home, we're roasting a few turkeys right here. By turkeys, we mean losers, failures, embarrassments. A lot of people biffed it in 2024, and we think that's worth pointing out. Get your plate ready, because we're carving them up. From politicians to cops to billionaire sports owners, here are the biggest flops of the year. Katie Hobbs. The 2 years that Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs has spent in office have been defined by gridlock. With a Republican-controlled state legislature, Hobbs has frequently exercised her veto pen, but also run into barriers herself. When Republicans couldn't confirm her agency nominees, Hobbs tried to squeeze through a loophole by technically demoting them. Maricopa County Superior Court judge quashed that idea. Hobbs has also taken flack for sketchy fund allocations to a group home and, recently, for allegations of nepotism by her state tourism director, who now will resign. Many of those problems could be solved by one thing: a Democratic-controlled legislature. Hobbs set out to flip both the Arizona House and Senate, with state Democrats spending $10 million to do so. While Hobbs was barely visible whenever Kamala Harris campaigned in Arizona, an absence for which there's been no satisfying explanation, she pounded the pavement, often for state legislature candidates, heading into November. And then, Democrats lost seats in both chambers, handing Republicans a more ironclad majority. For the next 2 years, Hobbs will face an even more hostile legislature than before. Already, buzz abounds about a possible 2026 primary challenge from Democratic Secretary of State Adrian Fontes or Attorney General Chris Mays. If Democrats can boot an incumbent president just months before an election, there's no telling what might happen to Hobbs' re-election bid in 2 years. Kerry Lake. This year was an endless parade of bad news for Lake, Arizona's highest profile MAGA firebrand. Instead of rising from the ashes of a gubernatorial loss 2 years ago, Lake cemented her status as a loser with a second consecutive statewide political defeat. Running for a U.S. Senate seat soon to be vacated by Kyrsten Sinema, Lake was always expected to lose to Democratic Representative Ruben Gallego. The year began with Lake getting booed at the annual meeting of the Arizona Republican Party. Lake then consistently ran behind Gallego in polling all year, unable to shake her gaffes from the previous cycle. Much of her campaign was defined by her comical flip-flops on abortion and by her court battles, one to overturn her 2022 election loss, and the other a defamation case brought against her by Maricopa County Recorder Stephen Ricker. Lake managed to claim victory in neither. As the year wore on, the flimsiness of Lake's support became more and more apparent. GOP megadonor Randy Kendrick urged her inner circle to support Lake's primary opponent, warning that Lake had no shot at winning the general election. National Republicans lost faith and stopped spending money on Lake's campaign. In the end, Lake did worse than before. Donald Trump won the state by 188,000 votes, but Lake lost to Gallego by about 80,000, a far worse margin than Lake had in her 2022 defeat. However, Lake did win something this year. Phoenix New Times awarded her the 2024 title for Best Dumpster Fire. Phoenix Police. The Phoenix Police Department is one rancid, ptomaine-filled fowl for which we are not giving thanks. In June, the U.S. Department of Justice released a damning 126-page report calling out the department for a host of abuses. Excessive force, plus mistreatment and discrimination against racial and ethnic minorities, the homeless, disabled people, and even children. Since then, Phoenix cops have done nothing but prove the DOJ right. Case in point, the recent release of footage showing Phoenix cops' shocking, unprovoked beatdown, tasering, and arrest of a deaf black man with cerebral palsy. The incident was a perfect example of what the DOJ described as force-first mentality, ingrained in Phoenix's supposed finest. According to the report, the city of Phoenix has trained its officers that all force, even deadly force, is de-escalation. No wonder Phoenix cops have shot and killed 12 people so far this year, matching last year's total and putting the police on a path to exceeding it. Our local political leaders have largely played ostrich over the need for a vigorous consent decree to rein in this unnecessary violence. And given Donald Trump's open encouragement of police brutality in the past, his November 5th victory likely means the chances for police reform in Phoenix are deader than the turkey on your Thanksgiving plate. Alex Morello. The most popular billionaires in America, besides inexplicably Elon Musk, are the owners of sports franchises that win titles. The most despised might be owners who rip beloved teams away from fans in search of a bigger buck elsewhere. Guess which one Alex Morello is? Until recently, Morello owned the Arizona Coyotes, a Valley staple since the 1990s. Their fan base was small but passionate, even as the team struggled to find consistent success or a permanent home in Maricopa County. Last season, the Coyotes were consigned to playing in the 5,000-seat Mullett Arena at Arizona State University. The idea that a pro hockey team won't work here is hardly ridiculous, but how Morello abandoned the Valley was. Morello and the Coyotes were all in on securing an arena deal in the Valley until, with a week left in the season, they suddenly weren't. By the time the team's final home game of 2024 rolled around, news had broken that the club would be sold and relocated to Salt Lake City, pulling the rug out from under fans. Morello retained the rights to start a new Coyotes franchise in the sale, but he bailed on a potential Phoenix land deal as soon as it got hard. Meanwhile, the Coyotes are no more. The Utah Hockey Club lives on. Tom Horn. If Tom Horn is good at one thing, it's waging dumb culture wars. The Republican superintendent of public instruction has spouted anti-trans rhetoric, made life more difficult for teachers, platformed the far-right education site PragerU, and claimed that rainbow stickers make kids dumber. He's endorsed the idea of abolishing the U.S. Department of Education and railed against critical race theory, which isn't even taught in Arizona schools. One thing Horn is bad at is his job. In the 2 years of his current term, his administration has been defined by lengthy delays in empowerment scholarship account reimbursements and somehow also a loosey-goosey standard for what ESA parents can buy with state funds. Then there's the $29 million in federal grants he nearly let slip. That saga was reported by the Arizona Republic, which chronicled how Horn's office missed an allocation deadline and then baselessly blamed the screw-up on his Democratic predecessor. It took a waiver from the U.S. Department of Education, which, again, Horn wants to abolish, to fix the blunder. The 79-year-old Horn, who bears an eerie resemblance to Beetlejuice's shrunken-headed minion Bob, has always been a magnet for scandal. If he spent 2024 making all the wrong headlines, well, that's just Horn doing what he does best. Skip Hall. When a suburban city council meeting makes national headlines, it's usually for a bad reason. And when the headlines are so big that people outside of Arizona know where Surprise is, or that Hall is its mayor, it's for a really bad reason. During the public comment portion of an August 20th city council meeting, Hall got into a verbal spat with libertarian activist Rebecca Massey. Massey was criticizing a proposed pay raise for the city attorney when Hall cut her off to warn her that she'd broken a meeting rule about not speaking negatively about city employees. Massey rightfully noted that such a rule violates the First Amendment. Then, Hall had her arrested. The arrest generated national outcry, led to an ongoing free speech lawsuit against the city, and prompted Republican lawmaker John Kavanaugh to request an investigation by the state attorney general. Quickly and quietly, Hall and the city council changed the rule in question, though it took 2 months for criminal charges against Massey to be dropped. Hall's term is expiring, and he'll soon return to civilian life, where he hopefully can't order police to do anything. Scottsdale-based High Science Show explores wild world of legal weed. The story was written by T.J. LeHeroux and was posted on November 26th. In 2018, Ed LeClaire had acoustic neuroma surgery to remove a benign tumor from his brain. His preparation for the procedure? He smoked a lot of weed. When they finally did the surgery, they said it was more cyst-like than tumor. So I believe the cannabis was helping to break it down, even though the neurosurgeon didn't think so, said LeClaire, a Scottsdale-based event promoter. The doctors and Big Pharma don't believe anything other than what they prescribe. The experience gave LeClaire an improbable idea. What if there was a television show, both entertaining and educational, that spotlighted passionate plant innovators in the newly legal weed industry? This month, that idea becomes a reality. High Science will debut on YouTube on November 27th. Over 8 episodes, the father-son duo of Rich Battenberg Jr. and Rick Battenberg III will take viewers on a rarely seen adventure that unravels the inside world of cannabis, according to a press release about the show. LeClaire serves as the show's founder, CEO, and executive producer. David McKillop, known for working on popular reality series such as Duck Dynasty, Pawn Stars, and Deadliest Catch, is the show's president and creative director. He came out of retirement, and the rest is history. Here we are, LeClaire said. He's somebody I'm just honored to have as my partner on this project. The two Battenbergs host the program, taking viewers on a journey through the cannabis industry and across the world. That includes a stop in Arizona. The show will highlight the cannabis innovations of Mo Asnani and Chip Boyden of Arizona wholesaler eLava. It will also feature Angel Shark advisors Yuri Downing, who was one of the first people to win a license to grow in the state. In addition, the show will visit Massachusetts, Australia, and Jamaica and introduce viewers to marijuana industry legends such as Joe Piasecki and Johnny Greenfingers. They are truly the pioneers. I call them the OGs of the industry, LeClaire said. I mean, some of them in the show are in their 40s and have been in the cannabis industry 25 or 30 years. Making the show. With no history of working in the TV industry, LeClaire's idea was a daydream until a friend set him up with McKillop, who's a 2-time Emmy winner. LeClaire said what hooked McKillop was the concept of maintaining ownership of the show's intellectual property instead of letting the network own it. That's why the show is on YouTube. Early in the development process, LeClaire and McKillop realized that finding a cable network would require significant compromises on the content of the show. We found out very fast that because cannabis is not federally legal, it was going to be difficult to put it on the show, LeClaire said. They all want cannabis shows, but they don't want to make it about cannabis. They want to make it into a venture capital show. They don't want to show products. The problem parallels the issues that marijuana industry professionals face. The trade isn't yet mainstream, and safe banking is an untenable or unaffordable luxury. True to the spirit of the show and the status of the marijuana trade, LeClaire and McKillop decided to stream it on YouTube. There, they can make a show that really digs into the world of cannabis. At the show's core is a serious idea about marijuana's potential as a plant-based medicine. For decades, the U.S. government mercilessly persecuted and prosecuted its use during the war on drugs. The show's characters are the true believers, iconoclasts who maintained their regard for the marijuana plant even when the powers that be declared it had no medical value whatsoever. Now, their skill and knowledge are important in mainstream culture and science, not just for getting frivolously stoned. These guys believe in this plant and have spent so many years in the underground that when it finally started going legal, they came out of the dark and into the light, LeClaire said. They're helping veterans with PTSD, mental illness, kids with epilepsy, people with anxiety, sleep disorder, and eating disorders. High Science is more than just a show to LeClaire. He also started the High Science Charity Foundation to support plant-based research, advocacy, and education. LeClaire said the foundation's work is especially focused on veterans with PTSD and underserved communities. He also expressed interest in mushroom-based therapy for PTSD. Should High Science embark upon a second season, LeClaire said it will focus on psychedelics. Plant-based therapy and clinical studies in plant-based medicine is the way to go, LeClaire said. And Big Pharma can't do nothing about it. Here's a story written by Tucker Sennett of Cronkite News and posted on the New Times website on November 29th. How NAU Marching Band secured a place in 2025 Macy's Parade. Certain staples are a part of many students' college experience, including sporting events and dorm life. But one thing can tie the whole thing together: the sound of a traditional and talented marching band. Northern Arizona University's Lumberjack Marching Band, locally known as the LMB, provides that and more for the school and community at the base of the San Francisco Peaks in Flagstaff. Throughout the summers, football seasons, basketball seasons, and more, the people of Flagstaff can hear the LMB as it brings a combination of classics and modern music to the Walk-Up Sky Dome. In 2025, the band will be rewarded for its efforts after being selected to perform in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade in New York City. And that's no small accomplishment, especially for a lesser-known university like NAU. There are over 100 applicants every year, and they select 10, and not all of those are college marching bands, NAU Marching Band Director Brent Levine says. We were really fortunate to be selected by the committee. The LMB will join the bands of Alcorn State University, University of North Alabama, and Temple University as the collegiate representatives in the parade. The parade began in 1924 and has included marching bands and drum lines since 1926. Levine's humility embodies the personality of the band as a whole. When people think of NAU, they think of a college high in the mountains of Arizona. They think of lumberjacks. They probably don't think of an elite marching band playing songs from Broadway musicals like West Side Story. Levine knows what the highest level of college marching bands looks like. I did my doctorate at Ohio State, and this is actually my first job after completing that program, he says. When I arrived, the band was actually already quite strong. Ohio State's marching band can be seen performing words and performing raucous renditions of popular music on Saturdays in Columbus, something Levine wanted to replicate on a smaller scale in Flagstaff. We've done things like have a giant spider crawl across the field when we played music from Spider-Man last year. But every great story has adversity. The Lumberjack Marching Band saw a significant number of departures during the COVID-19 pandemic, and Levine and his core leadership members worked hard to rebuild the band better than ever. They just did it in a new way. We have 78 majors spread across the marching band, which is absolutely insane, baton twirler Madeline Cleese says. We always want to create a culture that everyone can be a part of. Inclusivity and diversity are staples of the band. The diversity ranges from ethnicity to academic interest, and hometowns to music or marching experience. The spectrum is wide. Levine and his group of leaders quickly and smoothly molded that mix into one of the nation's most exciting shows. I come from a small town in Eagle River, Alaska, brass captain Avery Caldwell says. I was in a band of maybe 40 people, and we did not do any marching thing or basically any pep band thing. Caldwell mentioned his surprise about the community aspect of the band and the school. This is what is possible with the community and the support of everybody around you, he says. While Levine tried to guard his excitement about the Macy's performance next November, Caldwell and the other band members are visibly giddy when discussing their big moment. It is mind-blowing that this band is able to be a part of something as big as Macy's, Caldwell said. It really isn't this exact band that's going to Macy's, it's next year's band. But the only reason we're going to Macy's is because of the band from 2 years ago. So it takes a village to accomplish something like that. The work that goes into preparing for a weekly football game is intense. The 200-plus band members practice outside of the ASU Student Athlete High Performance Center, which was finished in 2022, on the football team's practice field 3 days a week, weather permitting. However, The work begins over the summer for the upcoming football and basketball season for Levine and his directors. The design process for the staff starts in May and June. We select music and figure out what we want to do, and we know pretty much how many folks want to do this by about mid-July, Levine said. Without the aid of student leaders, the Lumberjack Marching Band wouldn't have the success it does. The drum majors, who essentially are Levine's coaches on the field, make that possible. We go up on these big podiums and we actually conduct the marching band, drum major Samantha Fagan says. Everyone on the field, about 200 people, are looking at us. Most of the pizzazz and the amazing work is done by everyone on the field. As for learning the routines and marches, the preparation requires dedication and focus like any other sport. On top of that, training at altitude is difficult for most athletes at first, so marching has the same challenges in many ways. It's definitely a unique process, and there's not a lot I could compare it to, Caldwell says. It is very mental and very physical, just marching, moving around, and making sure that you're in unison with everybody around you. It's unlike anything I've ever done, and I think that's what makes it so special. The arts can breed competition. It's human nature to want to compete with others. The LMB is different in many ways, but a lack of unhealthy competition is certainly one of them. I would say that the best thing about NAU and the LMB is how little competition there is, Caldwell says. Everybody is so supportive of everyone else. I think that's one of the greatest things about this band. Perhaps the most impressive part of the LMB is the fact that they are heavily funded by the students who choose to participate. We're fundraising every dime to make this happen, Levine says, about the band having larger opportunities. While the trip to New York is a year away, the LMB will do everything it can to make its dream a reality and march from Central Park and West 77th Street to Macy's Herald Square on Thanksgiving. For now, 6,950 feet above sea level in the mountains of Flagstaff, Levine and his Lumberjacks will continue to hone their craft and prepare for their big moment. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook.